Rollo did not know. Earl Swithin was executed, and I was responsible for his death. I had no idea then that he was the first of so many. Rollo and Bart and Sir Reginald were punished with heavy fines, but one of the group had to die, and the Earl had actually murdered a man in church. That was the justification, but what really sealed his fate was that he had tried to defy the will of Queen Elizabeth. The Queen wanted England to understand very clearly that she, alone, had the right to appoint bishops, and anyone who interfered with her prerogative risked his life. Shocking though it was to kill an earl, she needed Swithin dead. I made sure the judge understood her wishes. As the crowd gathered in front of Kingsbridge Cathedral for the execution, Rollo stared hard at me, and I knew he suspected a trap, but I don't think he ever worked it out. Sir Reginald was there too, with a long scar across his head where the hair never grew back. The wound damaged his brain as well as his hair, and he never quite regained his wits. I know Rollo always blamed me for that. Bart and Marjorie watched too. Bart wept. Swithin was a wicked man, but his father. Marjorie looked like someone released from a horrible dungeon into the sunlight and fresh air. She had lost that sickly look, and she was dressed with her former panache, albeit in somber mourning colours. On her, a black hat with a black feather could still look playful. Her tormentor was on his way to hell, where he belonged, and she was free of him. Swithin was brought out of the Guildhall, and I had no doubt that the worst part of his punishment was the humiliating walk down the main street to the square, in front of a jeering throng of people he had always despised as his inferiors. His head was chopped off, decapitation being the mercifully quick death reserved for the nobility. And I imagine the end came as a release. Justice was done. Swithin was a murderer and a rapist who deserved to die. But I found that my conscience was not untroubled. I had lured him into an ambush. In a way, the death of poor George Cox was my responsibility. I had meddled in things that should have been left to the law, or, failing that, to God. I may yet go through anguish in hell for my sin, but if I had to live that time again, I would do the same, to end Marjorie's ordeal. I preferred to suffer myself than to know that her agony continued. Her well-being was more important to me than my own. I have learned, during the course of a long life, that that is the meaning of love. Part 3, 1566 to 1573. Chapter 14. Ibrahim Adabo was living his dream. He was free, rich, and happy. On a Sunday afternoon in the summer of 1566, he and his partner, Carlos Cruz, walked out of the city of Antwerp into the countryside. They were two prosperous, well-dressed inhabitants of one of the richest cities in the world. Together, they owned the largest iron-making concern in Antwerp. In brains, they were about equal, Ibrahim thought. He was older and wiser, but Carlos had the bold imagination of youth. Carlos was married to Imke, the daughter of his distant cousin Jan Volman, and they had two small children. Ibrahim, who would be 50 next year, had married Effie Dirks, a widow his own age, and had a teenage stepson who was employed in the ironworks. Ibrahim often thought nostalgically of the village where he had been born. If he could have turned back the years and avoided being taken as a prisoner of war and sold into slavery, he would have had a long, uneventful, and contented life in that village. When he thought this way, he felt sad. But he could not go back. For one thing, he had no idea how to get there. But there was something else. He knew too much. He had eaten of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, like Eve in the myth the Christians believed, and he could never return to the garden. He spoke Spanish and French and the local Brabant Dutch dialect, and had not uttered a word of Manding for years. He hung oil paintings in his house. He loved to listen to musical groups playing complex scores, and he was particular about the quality of his wine. He was a different man, With brains and hard work and luck, he had forged a new life. All he wanted now was to keep what he had won, but he feared he would not be able to. He and Carlos were not the only people leaving the city. Antwerpers often walked into the countryside in good weather, but today's crowds were abnormal. There were hundreds of people on the narrow country road. Ebriman knew many of them, men who supplied him with ore, others who bought his iron, families who lived in his street, keepers of shops where he bought meat and gloves and glassware. All were heading for the same place, a broad meadow known as Lord Hubert's Pasture. It was Carlos's children's favorite place to picnic, but the crowd on the road were not picnickers. They were Protestants. Many carried copies of the same small book, the Psalms, translated into French by the poet Clément Marot, printed in Antwerp. It was a crime to own the book, and the penalty for selling it was death, but it was easily available and cost a penny. Most of the younger men also carried weapons. Ebrima guessed that Lord Hubert's pasture had been chosen for the meeting because it was outside the jurisdiction of the Antwerp City Council, so the city watch had no authority there, and the rural police did not have the manpower to disperse such a crowd. Even so, there was always the danger of violence. Everyone had heard of the massacre of Vassy, and some of the younger men were undoubtedly in an aggressive mood. Carlos was a Catholic. Ebrima was what the Christians would have called a pagan, if they had known what was in his heart. But of course, they did not, for he pretended to be a devout Catholic, like Carlos. Even his wife, Evie, did not know, and if she wondered why he liked to go for riverside walks at dawn on Sunday mornings, she was tactful enough not to ask. Ebrima and Carlos both went regularly with their families to their parish church, and on big occasions to Antwerp Cathedral. Both feared that religious warfare in the Netherlands could destroy their happiness, as it had done for so many people across the border in France. Carlos was a simple soul philosophically, and he could not understand why anyone wanted to take up an alternative religion. But Ebrima saw, with sadness and alarm, what attracted so many Netherlanders to Protestantism. Catholicism was the creed of their Spanish overlords, and many Dutch people resented foreign domination. Also, Netherlanders were innovators, whereas the Catholic Church was conservative about everything, quick to condemn new ideas, slow to change. Worst of all, the clergy were not friendly to the commercial activities that had made so many Netherlanders rich, especially banking, which could not exist unless men committed the sin of usury. By contrast, the influential John Calvin, leader of the Geneva Protestants until his death 2 years ago, had allowed interest to be charged on loans. This summer, as a fresh wave of itinerant Calvinist pastors from Geneva gave informal sermons in the forests and fields of the Netherlands, the trickling spread of Protestantism had turned into a flood. Persecution was fierce, but intermittent. The governor of the Netherlands was Margarita, Duchess of Parma, the illegitimate half-sister of King Felipe of Spain. She was inclined to go easy on heretics for the sake of a quiet life, but her brother was determined to wipe out heresy in all his domains. When she became too tolerant, the bloodthirsty chief inquisitor, Peter Titelmans, would crack down. Protestants would be tortured, mutilated, and burned to death. But the hard line got little support even from Catholics. Most of the time, the laws were enforced lightly. Men such as Carlos were more interested in making and selling things. The new religion grew. How big was it now? Ebrima and Carlos were on their way to the open-air meeting to find out. City councillors wanted to know just how popular the alternative religion was. It was difficult to tell, normally, because Protestantism was semi-hidden. Today's meeting would be a rare chance to see how many Protestants there really were. So a councillor had unofficially asked Carlos and Ebrima, as solid Catholic citizens without official status, to discreetly count them. Judging by the numbers on the road, the total was going to be higher than expected. As they walked, Ebrima asked, "How is the painting coming along?" "He's almost finished." Carlos had commissioned a top Antwerp artist to paint a picture for the cathedral. Ibrima knew that, in his prayers, Carlos thanked God for his gifts and asked that he would be allowed to keep them. Like Ibrima, he did not take his prosperity for granted. He often mentioned the story of Job, the man who had everything and lost it all, and he would quote, "The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away." Ibrima was intrigued that Carlos did not reject the church after the persecution he had suffered in Seville. Carlos was not very forthcoming about his spiritual life, but over the years, Ibrima had gathered, from casual remarks and hints, that Carlos found great consolation in Catholic services, something similar to what Ibrima got from the water rite. Neither of them felt the same at an earnest Protestant service in a whitewashed church. Now Ibrima said, "What subject did you decide upon for the painting in the end?" "The miracle at Cana, when Jesus turned the water into wine." Ibrima laughed. "Your favorite Bible story. I wonder why." Carlos's love of wine was well known. Carlos smiled. "It will be unveiled in the cathedral next week." The painting would technically be a gift from the city's metalworkers, but everyone would know that it had been bought with Carlos's money. This was a measure of how quickly Carlos had become one of Antwerp's leading citizens. He was amiable and gregarious and very smart, and might be a city councillor one day. Ibrima was a different kind of man, introverted and cautious. He was just as smart as Carlos, but he had no political ambitions. Also, he preferred to keep his money for himself. Carlos added, "We'll have a big party afterward. I hope you and Effie will come." "Of course." They heard the singing before they reached their destination. Ibrima felt the hairs on the back of his neck stand up. The sound was awesome. He was used to chorus singing by choirs in Catholic churches, quite large choirs in cathedrals. But this was different. He had never before heard thousands of voices raised in the same song. The road passed through a little wood, then emerged at the top of a shallow rise from where they could see the whole of the meadow. It sloped down to a shallow stream and up the far side, and the entire space of 10 acres or more was covered with men, women, and children. On the far side, a pastor stood on a makeshift platform, leading the singing. The hymn was in French. "Si seulement que quand au val viendra d'ombre de mort, rien de mal ne craindra." Ibrima understood the French words and recognized them as a translation from the familiar Latin of the 23rd Psalm, which he had heard in church, but not like this. The sound seemed a mighty phenomenon of nature, making him think of a gale over the ocean. They really believed what they were singing, that as they walked through the valley of the shadow of death, they would fear no evil. Ibrima spotted his stepson, Matus, not far away. Matus still worshipped with his mother and stepfather every Sunday, but lately he had started to criticize the Catholic Church. His mother urged him to keep his doubts to himself, but he could not. He was 17, and for him, right was right, and wrong was wrong. Now Ibrima was troubled to see him with a group of youths, all carrying unpleasant-looking clubs. Carlos saw him at the same time. "Those boys seem to be looking for a fight," he said anxiously. But the atmosphere in the meadow was peaceful and happy, and Ibrima said hopefully, "I think they'll be disappointed today." "What a lot of people," Carlos said. "How many do you think?" "Thousands. I don't know how we're going to count." Carlos was clever with numbers. "Let's say there's half this side of the stream and half the other. Now imagine a line from here to the preacher. How many in the near quarter? Divided into four again." Ibrima took a guess. 500 in each 16th? Carlos did not respond to that, but said, "Here comes trouble." He was staring over Ibrima's shoulder, and Ibrima turned to look for the cause. He saw at once what had alerted Carlos. Coming along the road through the wood was a small group of clergy and men-at-arms. If they had come to break up the meeting, they were too few. This armed crowd, full of righteousness, would wipe them out. In the center of the group was a priest in his mid-60s, wearing an ostentatious silver cross outside his black robe. As he came closer, Ibrima saw that he had dark, deep-set eyes either side of a high-bridged nose, and a mouth set in a hard, determined line. Ibrima did not recognize the man, but Carlos did.
"This Peter Titelmans, Dean of Ronsa," he said. "The Grand Inquisitor."
Ibrima looked anxiously at Matus and his friends. They had not yet spotted the newcomer. What would they do when they realized the Grand Inquisitor had come to spy on their meeting? As the group approached, Carlos said,
"Let's stay out of his way. He knows me."
But he was too late. Titelmans met his eye, registered surprise, and said,
"I'm disappointed to see you in this nest of ungodliness."
"I'm a good Catholic," Carlos protested.
Titelmans tilted back his head, like a hungry hawk spotting movement in the grass.
"What would a good Catholic be doing at a Protestant psalm-singing orgy?"
Ibrima answered him.
"The city council needs to know how many Protestants there are in Antwerp. We've been sent here to count them."
Titelmans looked skeptical and spoke to Carlos.
"Why would I take the word of that Ethiopian? He's probably a Muslim."
"If only you knew," thought Ibrima.
Then he recognized one of Titelmans' entourage, a middle-aged man with salt and pepper hair, and the flushed complexion of one who loves wine.
"Father Hus there knows me," he said.
Hus was a canon of Antwerp Cathedral.
"Hus," said quietly, "both these men are good Catholics, Dean Peter. They go to St. James's Parish Church."
The psalm came to an end and the preacher began to speak. Some people pressed closer to hear his words shouted across the field. Others noticed Titelmans with his big silver cross, and there were angry mutterings.
Hus said nervously, "Sir, there are more Protestants here than we imagined possible, and if violence were to break out, we have too few men to protect you."
Titelmans ignored him. Looking sly, he said,
"If you too are what you claim to be, you can tell me the names of some of these wicked men."
He indicated the congregation with a wide sweep of his arm. Ibrima was not going to betray his neighbors to a torturer, and he knew Carlos would feel the same. He saw that Carlos was about to make an indignant protest, and forestalled him.
"Of course, Dean Peter," he said, "we'll be glad to give you names."
He made a pantomime of looking around, then said,
"At the moment I don't see anyone I know, unfortunately."
"That's unlikely. There must be 7,000 or 8,000 people here."
"Antwerp is a city of 80,000 inhabitants. I don't know them all."
"Just the same, you must recognize a few."
"I don't think so. Perhaps it's because all my friends are Catholics."
Titelmans was stumped, and Ibrima was relieved. He had survived the interrogation. Then he heard a voice cry out in the local Brabant Dutch dialect,
"Carlos! Ibrima! Good day!"
Ibrima spun around to see Albert Willemsen, his brother-in-law, the ironmaker who had helped them when they first came to Antwerp 6 years ago. Albert had built a blast furnace, just like theirs, and all had done well. With Albert were his wife, Petja, and their daughter, Drika, now 14, a slim adolescent with an angelic face. Albert and his family had embraced Protestantism.
"Don't you think this is great?"
Albert enthused.
"All these people singing God's word, and no one to tell them to shut up."
Carlos said quietly,
"Careful what you say."
But the ebullient Albert had not noticed Titelmans or his cross.
"Oh, come on now, Carlos. You're a man of tolerance, not one of those hardliners. You can't possibly see anything here that would displease the God of love."
Ibrima said urgently to Albert,
"Shut up."
Albert looked hurt and puzzled. Then Betia, his wife, pointed to the Grand Inquisitor, and Albert turned pale. But others were noticing Titelmans, and most of the nearby Protestants had now turned away from the preacher to stare. Matus and his friends were approaching, clubs in hands. Ibrima called out,
"Stay back, you boys, I don't want you here."
Matus ignored his stepfather and stood close to Drika. He was a big lad, who had not yet grown used to his size. His adolescent face wore a look that was part threatening,
part fearful. However, his attitude to Drika seemed protective, and Ibrima wondered if the boy might be in love. "I must ask Evie," he thought. "Father Hus said, 'We should return to the city now, Dean Peter.'"
Tittelmann seemed determined not to go away empty-handed. Pointing to Albert, he said, "Tell me, Father Hus, what is that man's name?"
Hus said, "I'm sorry, Dean, I don't know the man."
Ibrima knew that was a brave lie. Tittelmann turned to Carlos. "Well, you obviously know him. He speaks to you like an old friend. Who is he?"
Carlos hesitated. Tittelmann was right, Ibrima thought. Carlos could not pretend not to know Albert after such an effusive greeting.
Tittelmann said, "Come, come, if you're as good a Catholic as you claim to be, you'll be glad to identify such a heretic. If you don't, you shall be questioned in another place, where we have means of making you honest."
Carlos shuddered, and Ibrima guessed he was thinking of Pedro Ruiz undergoing the water torture in Seville. Albert spoke bravely.
"I shan't allow my French to be tortured on my account," he said. "My name is Albert Willemsen.
Profession? Ironmaker. And to women?
Leave them out of this.
No one is left out of God's mercy."
"I don't know who they are,"
Albert said desperately.
"They're two prostitutes I met on the road."
"They don't look like prostitutes. But I shall learn the truth."
Tittelmann turned to Hus.
"Make a note of the name. Albert Willemsen, ironmaker."
He gathered up the skirts of his robe, turned and walked back the way he had come, followed by his little entourage. The others watched him go. Carlos said, "Shit." The north tower of Antwerp Cathedral was more than 400 feet high. It had been designed as one of a pair, but the south tower had not been built. Ibrima thought it was more impressive on its own, a single finger pointing straight up to heaven. He could not help feeling awestruck as he entered the nave. The narrow central aisle had a vaulted ceiling that seemed impossibly high. It sometimes made him wonder if the God of the Christians might be real after all. Then he would remember that nothing they built could compete with the power and majesty of a river. Above the high altar was the pride of the city, a large carving of Christ crucified between two thieves. Antwerp was wealthy and cultured, and its cathedral was rich in paintings, sculptures, stained glass, and precious objects. And today Ibrima's friend and partner, Carlos, would add to that treasure. Ibrima hoped that this would make up for their abrasive encounter with the loathsome Peter Tittelmans. It was a bad thing to have the Grand Inquisitor for an enemy. On the south side was a chapel dedicated to Urban, the patron saint of winemakers. There the new painting hung, covered by a red velvet cloth. Seats in the little chapel had been reserved for Carlos's friends and family, and for the officials of the Metalworkers' Guild. Standing nearby, eager to see the new picture, were 100 or so neighbors and fellow businessmen, all in their best clothes. Ibrima saw that Carlos was glowing with happiness. He was seated in a place of honor in the church that was the center of the great city. This ceremony would confirm that he belonged here. He felt loved and respected and safe. Father Hus arrived to perform the service of dedication. In his short sermon, he said what a good Christian Carlos was, raising his children in piety and spending his money to enrich the cathedral. He even hinted that Carlos was destined to play a part in the city's government one day. Ibrima liked Hus. He often preached against Protestantism, but preaching was as far as he wanted to go. Ibrima felt sure he must have been reluctant to help Tittelmans, and did so only under pressure. The children became fidgety during the prayers. It was hard for them to listen for long to someone speaking their own language, let alone Latin. Carlos shushed them, but gently. He was an indulgent father. As the service came to an end, Hus asked Carlos to step forward and unveil the painting. Carlos took hold of the red velvet cover, then hesitated. Ibrima thought he might be about to make a speech, which would be a mistake. Ordinary people did not speak out in church, unless they were Protestants. Then Carlos pulled at the velvet, nervously at first, then more vigorously.
At last, the cover came down like a crimson waterfall, and the picture was revealed. The wedding was shown taking place in a grand townhouse that might have been the home of an Antwerp banker. Jesus sat at the head of the table in a blue robe. Next to him, the host of the feast was a broad-shouldered man with a bushy black beard, very like Carlos. And next to Carlos sat a fair, smiling woman who might have been Imke. A buzz of comment arose from the group standing in the nave, and there were smiles and laughter as they identified other faces among the guests. There was Ibrima in an Arab-style hat, with Effie next to him in a gown that emphasized her large bust. A richly dressed man next to Imke was clearly her father, Jan Vollmann, and the empty wine jars were being examined by a tall, thin, dismayed-looking steward, who resembled Adam Schmitz, Antwerp's best-known wine merchant. There was even a dog that looked just like Carlos's hound, Samson. The painting looked fine in the chapel, up against the ancient stones of the cathedral, sunnily lit by a south-facing window. The robes of the wealthy guests glowed orange, blue, and bright green against the white of the tablecloth and the pale walls of the dining room. Carlos was visibly thrilled. Father Hus shook his hand, then took his leave. Everyone else wanted to congratulate Carlos, and he went around the crowd, smiling and accepting the plaudits of his fellow citizens. Eventually, he clapped his hands and said, "Everybody, you're invited to my house, and I promise the wine won't run out." They walked in procession through the serpentine streets of the town center to Carlos's house. He led them to the upstairs floor, where food and wine stood ready on tables in the grand drawing room. The guests dug in with enthusiasm. They were joined by several Protestants who had not been in the cathedral, including Albert and his family. Ibrima picked up a goblet and took a long swallow. Carlos's wine was always good. He wiped his mouth with his sleeve. The wine warmed his blood and made him feel mellow. He talked amiably to Jan Vollmann about business, to Imke about her children, and to Carlos briefly about a customer who was late paying his bill. The customer was there, enjoying Carlos's hospitality, and Ibrima thought this was the moment to confront him and ask for the money. But Carlos did not want to spoil the mood. The guests became a little raucous. Children squabbled, adolescent boys tried to woo adolescent girls, and married men flirted with their friends' wives. Parties were the same everywhere, Ibrima thought, even Africa. Then Peter Titelmans came in. The first Ibrima knew of it was when a hush fell over the room, starting at the door and spreading to all four corners. He was talking to Albert about the merits of cast iron cannons as compared with bronze, when they both realized something was wrong and looked up. Titelmans stood in the doorway, wearing his big silver cross, again accompanied by Father Hus and four men-at-arms. Ibrima said, "What does that devil want?" Albert said with nervous hopefulness, "Perhaps she's come to congratulate Carlos on the painting." Carlos pushed through the quiet and crowd and spoke to Titelmans with a show of amity. "Good day, Dean Peter," he said. "Welcome to my house. Will you take a cup of wine?" Titelmans ignored that. "Are there any Protestants here?" he said. "I don't think so," Carlos said. "We've just come from the cathedral where we unveiled—" "I know what you did at the cathedral," Titelmans interrupted rudely. "Are there any Protestants here?" "I can assure you, to the best of my knowledge, you're about to lie to me. I can smell it." Carlos's bonhomie began to crack. "If you don't believe me, why ask the question?" "To test you. Now shut your mouth." Carlos sputtered. "I'm in my own house!" Titelmans raised his voice so that everyone could hear. "I'm here to see Albert Williamson." Titelmans seemed unsure which one was Albert. He had only seen him for a few minutes at Lord Hubert's pasture, and for a moment Ibrima hoped they might all pretend he was not present. But the crowd was not sufficiently quick-witted, and indeed many of them stupidly turned and looked directly at Albert. After a moment of fearful hesitation, Albert stepped forward. With a show of bravado, he said, "What do you want with me?" "And your wife," said Titelmans, pointing.
Unfortunately, Betjo was standing close to Albert, and Titelmans's guess was correct. Looking pale and scared, Betjo stepped forward.
And the daughter?
Rika was not standing with her parents, and Titelmans surely would not remember a 14-year-old girl.
The child is not here.
Carlos lied bravely. Perhaps she might be saved, Ebrima thought hopefully. But she did not want to be saved. A girlish voice piped up.
I am Trike Willemsen.
Ebrima's heart sank. He could see her by the window in a white dress, talking to his stepson, Matus, with Carlos's pet cat in her arms. Carlos said,
She's a mere child, Din, surely.
But Drike was not finished.
And I am a Protestant,
she said defiantly,
for which I thank the Lord.
From the guests came a murmur of mixed admiration and dismay.
Come here, said Titelmans.
She crossed the room with her head held high, and Ebrima thought,
Oh, hell. Take the three of them away,
said Titelmans to his entourage. Someone shouted, Why don't you leave us in peace? Titelmans looked angrily toward the source of the jeer, but he could not see who had spoken. However, Ebrima knew. He had recognized the voice of young Matus. Another man shouted,
Ja, go back to Ronsa!
The other guests started to cheer their approval and shout their own catcalls. Titelmans's men-at-arms escorted the Willemsen family out of the room. As Titelmans turned to follow, Matus threw a bread roll. It hit Titelmans's back. He pretended not to notice. Then a goblet flew through the air and hit the wall close to him, splashing his robe. The booing became louder and cruder. Titelmans barely retained his dignity as he hurried through the door before anything else could threaten him. The crowd laughed and clapped his exit. But Ebrima knew there was nothing to smile about. The burning of young Drika was scheduled for 2 weeks later. It was announced in the cathedral. Titelmans said that Albert and Betje had recanted their Protestantism, asked God's forgiveness, and begged to be received back into the bosom of the church. He probably knew their confessions were insincere, but he had to let them off with a fine. However, to everyone's horror, Drika had refused to renounce her religion. Titelmans would not let anyone visit her in prison, but Albert bribed the guards and got in anyway. However, he was unable to change her mind. With the idealism of the very young, she insisted she was ready to die rather than betray her lord. Ebrima and Efi went to see Albert and Betje the day before the burning. They wanted to give support and comfort to their friends, but it was hopeless. Betje wept without stopping, and Albert could barely speak. Drika was their only child. That day, a stake was planted in the pavement in the city center, overlooked by the cathedral, the elegant Great Market Building, and the grand unfinished City Hall. A cartload of dry firewood was dumped next to the stake. The execution was scheduled for sunrise, and a crowd gathered before dawn. The mood was grim, Ebrima noted. When hated criminals such as thieves and rapists were executed, the spectators mocked them and cheered their death agonies. But that was not going to happen today. Many in the crowd were Protestants, and feared this might one day happen to them. The Catholics, such as Carlos, were angered by the Protestants' troublemaking and fearful that the French wars of religion would spread to the Netherlands, but few of them believed it was right to burn a girl to death. Drika was led out of the town hall by Egmont, the executioner, a big man dressed in a leather smock and carrying a blazing torch. She wore the white dress in which she had been arrested. Ebrima saw at once that Titelmans, in his arrogance, had made a mistake. She looked like a virgin, which she undoubtedly was, and she had the pale beauty of paintings of the Virgin Mary. The crowd gave a collective gasp on seeing her. Ebrima said to his wife, Evi, This is going to be a martyrdom. He glanced at Matus and saw that the boy had tears in his eyes. One of the two west doors of the cathedral opened, and Titelmans appeared at the head of a little flock of priests, like black crows. Two men-at-arms tied Drika to the stake and piled the firewood around her feet. Titelmans began to speak to the crowd about truth and heresy. The man had no sense of the effect he had on people, Ebrima realized. Everything about him offended them, his hectoring tone, his his haughty look, and the fact that he was not from this city. Then Drika began to speak. Her treble rose above Tiedelmans's shout. Her words were in French. Mon Dieu, me paist sous sa puissance haute, c'est mon berger, de rien je n'aurai faute. It was the psalm the crowd had sung at Lord Hubert's pasture, the 23rd, beginning, The Lord is my shepherd. Emotion swamped the crowd like a tidal wave. Tears came to Ibrima's eyes. Others in the crowd wept openly. Everyone felt they were present at a sacred tragedy. Tiedelmans was furious. He spoke to the executioner, and Ibrima was close enough to hear his words. You were supposed to pull out her tongue! There was a special tool, like a claw, for removing tongues. It had been devised as a punishment for liars, but was sometimes used to silence heretics so that they could not preach to the crowd as they were dying. Egmont said sullenly, only if specifically instructed. Drika said, En tête, bien sûr, joignons les beaux herbages, couchez-moi fait, me même au clair rivage. She was looking up, and Ibrima felt sure she was seeing the green pastures and still waters waiting in the afterlife of all religions. Tiedelmans said, Dislocate her jaw. Very well, said Egmont. He was, of course, a man of blunted sensibility, but this instruction clearly offended even him, and he did not trouble to hide his distaste. Nevertheless, he handed his torch to a man-at-arms. Next to Ibrima, Matus turned around and shouted, They're going to dislocate her jaw! Be quiet, said his mother anxiously. But Matus's big voice had already reached far. There was a collective roar of anger. Matus's words were repeated throughout the crowd until everyone knew. Matus shouted, Let her pray! And the cry was repeated, Let her pray! Let her pray! Effie said, You'll get into trouble. Egmont went up to Drika and put his hands to her face. He thrust his thumbs into her mouth and took a firm grip of her jaw, so that he could wrench the bone from its sockets. Ibrima sensed a sudden violent movement beside him, then Egmont was struck on the back of the head by a stone thrown by Matus. It was a big stone, aimed well and hurled hard by a strong 17-year-old arm, and Ibrima heard the thud as it hit Egmont's skull. The executioner staggered, as if momentarily losing consciousness, and his hands fell from Drika's face. Everyone cheered. Tiedelmans saw the event slipping from his control. All right, never mind, light the fire, he said. Matus shouted, No! More stones were thrown, but they missed. Egmont took back his torch and put it to the firewood. The dry sticks blazed up quickly. Matus pushed past Ibrima and ran out of the crowd toward Drika. Evie shouted, Stop! Her son ignored her. The men-at-arms drew their swords, but Matus was too quick for them. He kicked the burning wood away from Drika's feet, then ran away, disappearing back into the crowd. The men-at-arms came after him, swords raised. The crowd scattered before them, terrified. Evie wailed, They'll kill him! Ibrima saw that there was only one way to save the boy, and that was to start a general riot. It would not be difficult. The crowd was almost there already. Ibrima pushed forward, and others went with him, surging around the now undefended stake. Ibrima drew his dagger and cut the ropes that bound Drika. Albert appeared and picked her up. She did not weigh much, and they disappeared into the crowd. The people turned on the priests, jostling them. The men-at-arms gave up searching for Matus and returned to defend the clergy. Tiedelmans hurried away toward the cathedral, and the priests went after him. Their walk turned into a run. The crowd let them go, jeering, and watched them as they passed through the elaborately carved stone archway, pushed open the great wooden door, and finally vanished into the darkness of the church. Albert and his family left Antwerp that night. Ibrima was one of only a handful of people who knew they were going to Amsterdam. It was a smaller town, but farther to the northeast, and therefore more removed from the centre of Spanish power at Brussels, for which reason it was prospering and growing rapidly. Ibrima and Carlos bought Albert's ironworks, paying him for it in gold, which he took with him in locked saddlebags on a sturdy pony. The lovelorn Matus wanted to go with them, and Ebrima, who remembered, albeit dimly, the power of adolescent romance, would have let him. But Albert said that Drika was too young to marry, and they must wait a year. Then Matus could come to Amsterdam and propose to her, if he still wanted to. Matus swore that he would, and his mother said, "We'll see." Tietelmans went quiet. There were no further confrontations, no more arrests. Perhaps he had realized that Antwerp Catholics disliked his extremism, or he might just have been biding his time. Ebrima wished the Protestants would go quiet too, but they seemed to have become more confident, not to say arrogant. They demanded tolerance and the right to worship as they wished, but they were never satisfied with that, he thought, with exasperation. They believed their rivals were not just mistaken, but evil. Catholic practices, the ways in which Europeans had worshipped for hundreds of years, were blasphemous, they said, and must be abolished. They did not practice the tolerance they preached. It worried Ebrima that the Spanish overlords and their allies in the priesthood seemed to be losing their grip on authority. Hatred and violence seethed under the surface of city life. Like all entrepreneurs, he just wanted peace and stability so that he could do business. He was doing just that, negotiating with a buyer in the ironworks, perspiring a little in the summer heat on the 20th day of August, when the trouble boiled over again. He heard a commotion in the street, running footsteps, breaking glass, and the raucous shouts of overexcited men. He hurried out to see what was going on, and Carlos and Matus joined him. A couple of hundred youths, including a handful of girls, were hurrying along the street. They carried ladders, pulleys, and ropes, as well as cruder tools, such as wooden staffs, sledgehammers, iron bars, and lengths of chain. "What are you doing?" Ebrima shouted at them, but no one answered his question. The glass Ebrima had heard breaking was a window in the house of Father Hus, who lived in the same street as the ironworks. But that appeared to have been a passing fancy, and the mob was heading for the city center in a seemingly purposeful mood. Carlos said, "What the hell are they up to?" Ebrima could guess, and he hoped he was wrong. The three men followed the crowd to the market square where Drika had been rescued. There the youths gathered in the center, and one of them asked for God's blessing, speaking Brabant Dutch. Among Protestants, anyone could pray extempore, and they could use their own language instead of Latin. Ebrima was afraid they had come to the market square because that was where the cathedral stood, and his fear turned out to be right. When the prayer ended, they all turned as one, clearly following a prearranged plan, and marched to the cathedral. The entrance was a pointed Gothic arch under an ogee. On the tympanum was carved God in Heaven, and the concentric orders of the arch were filled with angels and saints. Next to Ebrima, Carlos gasped with horror as the group began to attack the carvings with their hammers and makeshift weapons. As they smashed the stonework, they yelled Bible quotations, making the scriptures sound like curses. Carlos yelled at them, "Stop this! There will be retaliation!" No one took any notice. Ebrima could tell that Matus was itching to join them. As the boy took a step forward, Ebrima took his arm in a strong ironmaker's grip. "What would your mother say?" he said. "She worships here. Stop and think." "They're doing God's work," Matus yelled. The rioters discovered that the big cathedral doors were locked. The priests had seen them coming. Ebrima felt relieved. At least the damage they could do was limited. Perhaps they would wind down now. He released Matus's arm. But the mob ran round to the north of the church, looking for another way in. The onlookers followed. To Ebrima's consternation, they found a side door unlocked. The priests in their panic must have overlooked it. The mob pushed through into the church, and Matus pulled away from Ebrima. By the time Ebrima got inside, the Protestants were running in all directions, yelling in triumph, lashing out at any carved or painted image. They seemed drunk, though not with wine. They were possessed by a frenzy of destruction. Both Carlos and Ebrima yelled at them to stop, and other older citizens joined in the appeal, but it was useless. There were a few priests in the chancel, and Ebrima saw some of them fleeing through the south porch. One did the opposite, and came toward the intruders, holding up both hands as if to stop them. Abrima recognized Father Hus.
"You are God's children,"
he kept saying. He walked directly at the charging youths.
"Stop this and let's talk."
A big lad crashed into him, knocking him to the floor, and the others ran over him. They pulled down precious hangings and threw them into a pile in the middle of the crossing, where screeching girls set fire to them using lighted candles from an altar. Wooden statues were smashed, ancient books were torn, and costly vestments were ripped up, and the debris was added to the flames. Ebrima was appalled, not just by the destruction, but by its inevitable consequences. This could not be allowed to pass. It was the most outrageous provocation of both King Felipe and Pope Pius, the two most powerful men in Europe. Antwerp would be punished. It might be a long time coming, for the wheels of international politics turned slowly, but when it happened, it would be dreadful. Some of the group were even more serious. They had clearly planned this, and they gathered around the high altar, their target obviously the massive sculpture. They quickly set their ladders and pulleys in positions that they must have prearranged. Carlos was aghast.
"They're going to abuse the crucified Christ," he said.
He stared in horror as they tied ropes around Jesus and hacked at his legs to weaken the structure. They kept shouting about idolatry, but it was clear even to the pagan Ebrima that it was the Protestants who were perpetrating the blasphemy here. They worked the pulleys with determined concentration, tightening the ropes, until at last the dying Jesus tilted forward, cracked at the knees, and was finally torn from his place and thrown to the ground face down. Not satisfied, the Protestants attacked the fallen monument with hammers, smashing the arms and head with a glee that seemed satanic. The two carved thieves, crucified either side of where Jesus had been nailed, now seemed to look mournfully down on his shattered body. Someone brought a flagon of communion wine and a golden chalice, and they all congratulated one another and drank. A shout from the south side made Ebrima and Carlos turn. With a shock, Ebrima saw that a little group had gathered in the chapel of St. Urban, staring up at the painting Carlos had commissioned of the miracle at Cana.
"No!"
Carlos roared, but no one heard. They ran across the church, but before they got there, one of the boys had raised a dagger and slashed the canvas from one side to the other. Carlos threw himself at the boy, knocking him to the ground, and the knife went flying. But others grabbed both Carlos and Ebrima and held them fast, struggling but helpless. The boy Carlos had attacked got up, apparently unhurt. He picked up his knife and slashed the canvas again and again, tearing the images of Jesus and the disciples and the representations of Carlos and his family and friends among the painted wedding guests. A girl brought a taper and put it to the shredded canvas. The painted fabric first smoldered and smoked, then eventually a small flame appeared. It spread rapidly, and soon the entire picture was blazing. Ebrima ceased to struggle. He looked at Carlos, who had closed his eyes. The young hooligans let them both go and went off to vandalize something else. Released, Carlos fell to his knees and wept. Chapter 15. Alison Mackay was in prison with Mary, Queen of Scots. They were confined in a castle on an island in the middle of a Scottish lake called Loch Leven. They were guarded day and night by 15 men-at-arms, more than enough to watch over 2 young women. And they were going to escape. Mary was indomitable. She did not have good judgment. Alison admitted to herself in the darkest hours of the night that just about every decision the Queen had ever taken had turned out badly. But Mary never gave up. Alison loved that about her. Loch Leven was a grim place. The house was a square tower of grey stone with small, mean windows to keep out the cold wind that blew hard across the water, even in summer. It was set in a compound less than 100 yards across. Outside was a narrow strip of scrubland, then the lake. When the weather was stormy, the strip was submerged, and the waves lashed the stones of the perimeter wall. The lake was broad, and it took half an hour for a strong man to row to the mainland. This was a hard prison from which to escape, but they had to try. They were miserable. Alison had never imagined until now that boredom could drive her to contemplate suicide. They had been raised in the glittering court of France, surrounded by people in gorgeous clothes and priceless jewels, invited every day to banquets and pageants and plays. Their everyday conversation had been of political plots and social intrigue. The men around them started wars and ended them. The women were queens and the mothers of kings. After that, Lochleven was purgatory. It was 1568. Alison was 27 and Mary 25. They had been at Lochleven almost a year, and Alison had spent much of that time brooding about where they had gone wrong. Mary's first mistake had been to fall for and then marry Queen Elizabeth's cousin, Henry, Lord Darnley, a charming drunk who had syphilis. Alison had felt torn, happy to see Mary in love, but appalled by her choice of man. Love quickly wore off, and when Mary became pregnant, Darnley murdered her private secretary, whom he suspected of fathering the child. If there was a nobleman in Scotland even worse than Darnley, it was, in Alison's opinion, the quarrelsome and violent Earl of Bothwell, and Mary's second mistake had been to encourage Bothwell to kill Darnley. Bothwell had succeeded, but everyone knew or guessed what had happened. Neither Mary nor Alison had anticipated the reaction of the Scots. They were an upright nation, and Catholics and Protestants alike disapproved of this royal immorality. Mary's standing with the Scottish people fell off a cliff. Alison felt that a storm of bad luck was sweeping over them when Bothwell kidnapped them and forced Mary to spend the night with him. In other circumstances, the nation would have been outraged by this attack on their queen and would have rallied to her defense. But by then her reputation was stained, and Mary could not feel sure of popular support. Together, they decided the only way to restore Mary's respectability was for her to marry Bothwell and pretend that he had not really raped her. Bothwell's fed-up wife obtained a quickie divorce that was not recognized by the Catholic Church, and they were married immediately. That was the third mistake. 26 outraged Scottish noblemen raised an army and overwhelmed the forces of Bothwell and Mary. They captured her, forced her to abdicate in favor of her one-year-old son James, and imprisoned her here at Lochleven, without her baby boy. All these events were undoubtedly watched avidly by Queen Elizabeth of England. In principle, Elizabeth supported Mary as the incontestably rightful Queen of Scotland, but in practice, no rescue party appeared on the horizon. Elizabeth's true attitude was probably that of someone who hears two drunks fighting in the street at night. It did not matter who won, so long as neither tried to get into the house. While Mary was with Darnley, Alison married a good Catholic, a man with hazel eyes and a mane of blonde hair who reminded her of Pierre Aumond. He was kind and affectionate, but he expected Alison to serve him, not Mary, which she found difficult, even though she knew she should have anticipated it. She became pregnant but miscarried after 4 months. Soon afterward, her husband died in a hunting accident, and it was almost a relief to Alison to return to her familiar role as Mary's dedicated right-hand woman. And now, this.
"No one else has loved me the way you love me," Mary had said during one of the long, dark Scottish evenings at Lochleven,
and Alison had blushed with a vague but strong emotion.
"My father died when I was a baby," Mary had said. "My mother mostly lived elsewhere. All three of my husbands have been hopelessly weak in their different ways. You've been mother and father and husband to me. Isn't that strange?"
It had made Alison cry. Their jailer was Sir William Douglas, owner of Lochleven. Mary had a remarkable power to win affection, and Sir William had fallen for her. He acted like an obliging host entertaining a distinguished house guest. His daughters adored Mary. They found the notion of an imprisoned queen madly romantic. But his wife, Lady Agnes, was not seduced. Agnes had a strong sense of duty, and she remained insistently watchful. However, Agnes had just given birth to her 7th child and was still confined to her room, which was one reason why this was the moment for an escape bid. Mary was still being guarded by Captain Drysdale and his men-at-arms, but today was Sunday, May 2nd, so the soldiers were enjoying the May Day revels, and drinking more than usual. Alison hoped they would become careless by late afternoon, when she and Mary planned to make their getaway. It would be difficult, but they had collaborators. Also resident at Lochleven was Sir William's handsome half-brother George, nicknamed Pretty Geordie, and Willie Douglas, a tall 15-year-old orphan who Alison thought was probably an illegitimate son of Sir William. Mary had set out to win the heart of Pretty Geordie. She had been allowed to send for her clothes, although not her jewels, and she was able to dress well. In any case, George was no great challenge. Mary had always been alluring, and here on this tiny island she had no rivals. With such a small group of people in a confined space, romantic emotions could heat up fast. Alison guessed it was not difficult for Mary to play the game, for George was charming as well as good-looking. Mary's feelings for him might even have been genuine. Alison was not sure what favours Mary granted George, more than mere kisses, she assumed, for George was a grown man, but less than sexual intercourse, because Mary, with her besmirched reputation, could not risk the further disgrace of an illegitimate pregnancy. Alison did not ask Mary for the details. It was a long time since the happy days in Paris, when they had been adolescent girls who told one another everything. But all that mattered now was that George was so badly smitten that he longed to play the part of the medieval knight and rescue his beloved from the castle of despair. Alison herself had worked on young Willie. Again, it was no great challenge, even though Alison was almost twice his age. Only just out of puberty, Willie would have fallen in love with any attractive woman who paid him attention. Alison needed only to talk to him and ask him about his life, while standing a little too close to him, and to kiss him in a way that was almost sisterly, though not quite, and to smile when she caught him staring at her breasts, and to make arch remarks about "you men," to bolster his courage. She had no need to grant sexual favours to this boy who was only just a man. In the deep recesses of her half-conscious mind, she felt a tiny regret about this, something she was embarrassed to admit even to herself. But Willie had succumbed easily, and was now her slave. George and Willie had been smuggling Mary's letters in and out of the prison for some months, but with difficulty. Escape would be much harder. Mary could not cross the little compound without being seen, for it was home to about 50 people, as well as the family and the men-at-arms. There were Sir William's secretaries, and a large staff of household servants. The gate was kept locked, and anyone who wanted to come and go had to get it unlocked or climb over the wall. Three or four boats were always pulled up on the beach, but Mary would need a strong accomplice to row her, and she could quickly be followed. Then, on the mainland, she would need friends with horses to whisk her away to a hiding place, somewhere safe from pursuit. There was such a lot that could go wrong. Alison found it hard to sit still during the morning service in the chapel. She was desperate to escape, but she also feared the consequences if they were caught. She and Mary would probably be confined to one room, perhaps even forbidden those walks along the top of the perimeter wall that, though depressing, at least gave them fresh air and a distant sight of the world outside. Worst of all, they might be separated. Mary was nothing if not bold, and she was ready to take the risk, as Alison was. But the penalty for failure would be dire. After church, there were May Day festivities. Willie excelled himself as Lord of Misrule, doing a hilarious drunk act, while shrewdly remaining one of the few people on the island who was completely sober. Pretty Geordie was on the mainland, and should by now have been in the lakeside village of Kinross. It was his job to assemble horses and men to escort Mary and Alison away from there before they could be recaptured. Alison was frantic to know whether he had carried out his part of the plan. She was anxiously awaiting a signal from him. Mary dined early in the afternoon with Sir William and the family, and Alison and Willie helped to serve. The dining room was on an upper floor of the square tower, with views from the little windows to the mainland, a necessary defensive feature. Alison had to stop herself constantly looking over the water. At the end of the meal, Willie left. The plan was that he would scramble over the wall and wait outside for a boat bringing a message from George saying that all was ready. During the planning of the escape, Young Willie had suggested that Mary should jump off the wall to the ground outside, a drop of 7 feet that he did easily. As an experiment, Alison had tried it and had sprained her ankle. They could not risk Mary's being slowed by an injury, so Willie's suggestion had been dropped. Instead, they would have to leave by the gate, which meant getting hold of a key. Alison, as a noble woman as well as a servant, was permitted to join the others at table as they sat chatting after dinner, eating nuts and fruit, Sir William sipping wine. There was not much to talk about on Lochleven, but conversation was the main form of entertainment for lack of much else. It was Sir William's mother, Lady Margaret, who glanced out of the window and noticed something on the far shore. "Who are those horsemen, I wonder?" she said in a tone of mild curiosity. Alison froze. How could George be so careless? He was supposed to keep his men out of sight. If Sir William became suspicious, he could easily lock Mary in her room, and then the plan would be wrecked. Surely it could not have failed already. Sir William looked out and frowned. "No reason for them that I know of." Mary rose to the occasion brilliantly. "I must speak to you, Lady Margaret, about your son James, my brother," she said in a challenging voice. That got everyone's attention. Lady Margaret in her youth had been one of the many mistresses of Mary's father, King James V. She had borne his illegitimate son, James Stuart, the half-brother Alison had met at Saint-Dizier with the enigmatic Ned Willard, when the two young men had tried to persuade Mary not to return to Scotland. For Mary to raise this topic was not good manners. Embarrassed, Lady Margaret said, "James is in France, visiting Admiral Coligny, the hero of the Huguenots. Madam, there is nothing I can do about James, as you surely know." Mary kept everyone looking at her instead of out of the window. Indignantly, she said, "I have been fond of him. I made him Earl of Moray." Margaret was intimidated by this suddenly angry young queen. Sounding nervous, she said, "And I know how grateful he is for your kindness." No one was looking out of the window now. "Then why has James plotted against me?" Mary cried. Alison knew that her anger, though calculated, was genuine. "Since I was brought here, he has forced me to sign abdication papers, he has crowned my baby son as King James VI, and he has made himself regent. He is now King of Scotland in all but legitimacy." The Douglases felt sorry for Mary, but they undoubtedly approved of what James Stuart had done, and they looked awkward, which was fine, Alison thought, for they had forgotten about the horsemen on the shore. Sir William tried to be pacific. "Of course this is not how you would wish it, madam," he said to Mary. "On the other hand, your child is king and your brother is regent, so the arrangement has a degree of legitimacy that cannot be denied." Alison stole a glance out of the window. There was no sign of horsemen now. She imagined that George might have angrily told them to get away from the shore. Perhaps they had been in King Ross for an hour or two and were getting restless, letting discipline slip. But the semblance of normality had been restored. The crisis was over, but it had underlined how chancy the whole plan was, and it left her feeling even more edgy. Mary seemed to run out of patience.
"I feel tired after the May Day festivities," she said, standing up. "I'm going to rest."
Alison went with her. Outside the door, a dark and narrow spiral staircase of stone led up and down to other floors. They climbed to the Queen's quarters. Mary was not in the least tired. She was excited and jittery, constantly getting up from her chair to go to the window, then returning and sitting down again. Alison checked their disguises, folded in a trunk under Mary's gowns. They had got hold of coarse, homemade woolen linen kirtles of the kind worn over petticoats by the many serving women at the castle, complete with a type of headdress known as a Flemish hood, which covered the hair and made it difficult for others to see the face, except from directly in front. Servants sometimes wore stout leather boots that were so hard, Mary and Alison could not even walk in them. But fortunately, the women also used their mistresses' cast-off silk and satin slippers. For weeks, Alison and Mary had been wearing old shoes whenever they were alone, to make them look shabby enough to have been handed down. Their main problem was Mary's height. That could not be disguised. No other woman on the island was anywhere near so tall. Alison could hardly imagine that they could get away with it. She put the disguises away again. They had to be patient for another hour. Then, at 6 o'clock, Mary's supper was brought to her room. As usual, it was served to her by Sir William, a courtesy by a jailer to his royal prisoner. Alison left the room and went looking for Willie, to find out what was happening. Outside, a holiday game of handball was in progress, soldiers versus servants, with supporters cheering each side. Alison noticed that Drysdale, who was supposed to keep a close eye on Mary, was captain of the soldiers' team. That was good, she thought. He was distracted. Willie was coming across the courtyard toward her, looking excited.
"It's come,"
he whispered, and showed her a pearl earring. This was the signal from George on the mainland. The earring meant all was ready for Mary's escape. Alison was thrilled, but Willie had been less than discreet.
"Close your fist," she hissed at him. "We don't want anyone asking questions."
Fortunately, the people in the courtyard were intent on the game.
"Sorry,"
said Willie. He closed his fingers around the jewel, then passed it to Alison with a display of casualness. Alison said,
"Now, slip over the wall and sabotage all the boats but one." "I'm ready,"
he said, pulling aside his coat to reveal a hammer hanging from his belt. Alison returned to Mary's quarters. Mary had not eaten much. Alison could imagine why. She herself was so tense that she could not have swallowed food. She handed Mary the jewel, saying,
"Here's the earring you lost. One of the boys found it."
Mary knew what it meant.
"I'm so glad,"
she said, beaming. Sir William looked out of the window and grunted in surprise.
"What is that foolish boy doing with the boots?"
he said in a tone that combined fondness with exasperation. Alison followed his gaze. Willie was on the foreshore, kneeling in one of three boats that were drawn up on the beach. What he was doing was not obvious to a distant observer, but Alison knew he was making a hole in the hull so that the boat could not be used to pursue escapers. Alison suffered a moment of pure panic. She had no idea what to do. She turned to Mary and mouthed,
"Willie."
Mary knew what Willie was supposed to do to the boats. Once again, she showed her ability to think fast in an emergency.
"I feel terribly faint,"
she said, and slumped in her chair with her eyes closed. Alison realized what she was up to and played along.
"Oh, dear God, what's wrong?"
she said, putting on a frightened voice. She knew that Mary was faking, but Sir William did not. Looking fearful, he came at once to Mary's side. If she died in his care, he would be in trouble. The regent, James Stuart, would be obliged to deny that he had connived at her murder, and to demonstrate his sincerity, he might well have Sir William executed.
"What is it? What has happened?"
Sir William said. Alison said,
"She should have strong wine to revive her. Sir William, do you have some canary?"
"Of course. I'll fetch it at once."
He left the room.
"Well done,"
Alison said quietly to Mary. Mary said,
"Is Willie still at it?"
Alison looked out of the window. Willie was doing the same thing in a different boat.
"Hurry up, Willie,"
she murmured. How long did it take to make a hole in a boat? Sir William returned with a steward carrying a jug of wine and a goblet. Alison said,
"My hands are shaking. Sir William, will you hold the cup to our lips?"
Sir William obliged, taking the opportunity to put a hand tenderly behind Mary's head, and did not think to look out of the window. Mary took a sip, coughed, and pretended to revive a little. Alison made a show of touching her forehead and feeling her pulse.
"You'll be all right now, Your Majesty, but perhaps you should retire for the night."
"Very well,"
said Mary. Sir William looked relieved.
"Then I'll leave you," he said. "Good night, ladies."
He glanced out of the window. Alison looked too. Willie was no longer on the beach. It was not possible to see whether he had succeeded in holding the boats. Sir William left without making any comment. The steward cleared the table and went out. Then Alison and Mary were alone. Mary said,
"Did we get away with it?"
"I think so.
Sir William may forget what he saw from the window. He's been drinking all afternoon, and he must be at least a little fuddled by now." I hope suspicion doesn't make Sir William vigilant. Will he still ask to steal the key?
Sir William kept the gate key close at hand. When someone went to the mainland or came back, he would either open the gate himself or entrust the key to a guard for a few minutes only. Otherwise, no one needed to leave the compound. There was nothing outside apart from the boats. Mary and Allison had to get out of the compound, and Allison's experiment had established that they could not climb over the wall, so they had to unlock the gate. Willie had assured Allison and Mary that he would be able to steal the key without Sir William's noticing. They were dependent on him.
"We should be dressed ready," said Allison.
They took off their costly gowns and put on the rough kirtles, then changed their shoes for old, worn ones. The Flemish hoods covered their heads and usefully concealed Mary's distinctive auburn hair. Now all they could do was wait. Sir William liked Willie to serve his supper. His fondness for the orphan boy was what led everyone to speculate that they were father and son. But Willie's loyalty had been undermined by Allison. She imagined that right now, one floor down, Willie was putting down and picking up plates and napkins and jugs. Perhaps the key lay on the table next to Sir William's wine goblet. She visualized Willie dropping a napkin over the key, then picking up both. Would he get away with it? How drunk was Sir William? They could only wait and see. If the plan worked, Mary's escape would be a political earthquake. She would disavow the abdication papers she had been forced to sign and claim her rightful throne. Her half-brother James would assemble a Protestant army, and Mary's Catholic supporters would rally, those of them who had not lost faith in her. The civil war would be renewed. Mary would be cheered by her brother-in-law, the King of France, who was fighting a similar long-running civil war with the Huguenots. The supportive Pope would be glad to annul her marriage with Bothwell. Speculation about possible husbands for her would be renewed in every royal court from Rome to Stockholm. The European balance of power would shift seismically. Queen Elizabeth of England would be furious. All that depended on Willie Douglas, age 15. There was a tap at the door, soft but insistent. Allison opened it. Willie stood there, beaming, holding a big iron key. He stepped inside and Allison closed the door. Mary stood up.
"Let's go at once," she said.
Willie said, "They're still at table. Sir William is asleep over his wine, but Lady Margaret is talking to our granddaughters. They might see us through the open door as we go down." The spiral staircase went past the doors to each floor of the castle. Allison said,
"But this is a good time. The soldiers are still playing handball."
Mary said decisively,
"We have to take chances. We'll go."
Willie looked woebegone.
"I should have closed the dining room door. I never thought of it."
Allison said,
"Never mind, Willie. You're doing wonderfully well."
She gave him a soft kiss on the lips. He looked as if he had gone to heaven. Allison opened the door and they went out. Willie led the way, followed by Mary, with Allison last. They tried to tread softly on the stone of the spiral staircase, hoping not to attract attention. Both women pulled their hoods forward as they approached the open door to the dining room. Light spilled from the doorway, and Allison heard low female voices. Willie went past without looking in. Mary put her hand to her face as the light fell on her. Allison waited to hear a shout of alarm. She walked past the door and went on down the stairs after the others. She heard a peal of laughter, and imagined Lady Margaret chortling scornfully at their pathetic attempt to disguise themselves, but it seemed her amusement had some other cause. They had not been noticed, or, if Lady Margaret had happened to glance up, perhaps she had seen nothing more remarkable than a few servants passing the doorway on some errand. They went outside. From the tower door to the compound gate was just a few steps, but it seemed more. The courtyard was full of people watching the game. Allison spotted Drysdale, hitting the ball with his two hands clamped together, concentrating hard. Then Willie was at the gate. He put the iron key into the big lock and turned it. Allison kept her back to the crowd, hiding her face, but that meant she could not tell whether anyone was looking at them. It took an effort of will to resist the temptation to look back over her shoulder. The massive timber gate creaked noisily as Willie pushed it open. Did anyone hear that sound over the cheering?
The three fugitives stepped through. No one came after them. Willie closed the gate behind them.
"Lock it," said Allison. "It may slow them down."
Willie locked the gate, then dropped the key into the barrel of the cannon that stood beside the entrance. No one had seen them. They ran down to the beach. Willie took hold of the one undamaged boat and pushed it into the shallows, then held it with its keel just touching the shore. Allison clambered in, then turned to help Mary. The Queen stepped into the boat and sat down. Willie pushed it off from the beach, jumped in, and started to row. Allison looked back. There was no sign that they had been missed. No one on the ramparts, no one leaning out of the castle windows, no one running down to the beach. Was it possible that they had escaped? The sun had not yet set, and a long summer evening stretched ahead. The breeze, though stiff, was warm. Willie pulled strongly at the oars. He had long arms and legs, and he was motivated by love. All the same, their progress across the wide lake seemed